We don't have to have a quorum. We have informational meeting.
Hi, guys.
Welcome. I'm going to open up the Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability for September 22nd. Welcome, everyone. We're going to start out with an informational meeting. What do we got, Adam?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, we've got a panel today on some public transparency task force that has been done by the Attorney General. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Chair Riley.
So, come on up.
Hello, Senator Riley. Chair Riley, I guess I'm supposed to say, members of the committee. My name is Michael Cronin, and I should have two teammates.
Well, bring them on up.
Can I invite them up?
That yes, evening? Absolutely.
Jeb and, oh, Rob's not here, but he shut out. But thank you for having me here today, my team here today. I am chairing, on behalf of Attorney General Rosenblum, the Attorney General's Public Records Law Reform Task Force. The task force started meeting in October of last year, so we've been meeting for just about a year now. We've been having meetings most every month. We took a little bit of time off during the short session. The task force is comprised of members of the press, state and local government representatives, and a couple of more public members. Specifically, we have Jeb Bledene is to my right here. He represents the Newspaper Publishers Association. Other media representatives are Les Zeitz, who's with the Society of Professional Journalists, and Keith Shipman, who represents the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. In addition to Rob Bovet, on behalf of the counties, we have Mark Landauer of the Special Districts, and Scott Winkles of the Association of Oregon Cities. The government representatives, myself and the Attorney General, in addition to Robert Taylor, who's the Deputy Secretary of State, and Ben Swade, who's on the Governor's Office. So it's a pretty broad group in terms of those stakeholders, and then we have a public member in the person of Betty Reynolds, and also Jesse O'Brien, who works for Osberg, is on the task force. So it's a pretty good stakeholder group. As I said, we've been having monthly meetings. We've also been doing a number of meetings around the state to hear from the public. We had public outreach meetings in Salem, in Eugene, in Portland, and in Bend. And as we sort of heard, I think, what we expected to hear at those meetings. We heard a lot of people talking about the costs of getting public records in this state. We heard a lot of people talking about how those costs could sometimes seem punitive or just unreasonable. We heard, on the converse, from people who work in governments, from city recorders and others, that, you know, without the ability to charge costs, they would feel that they were running the risk of just having their business turned entirely to the business of providing public records rather than doing the other work that they're required to do. We also heard a lot from people about the time that it takes for public records to be disclosed when they're requested. Oregon is one of just a handful of states that has no specific time frame in the statute explaining when public bodies are expected to respond to public records requests. And for members of the media, I think especially, that can be very frustrating when they're working on deadline. For members of the public, I think it creates more of a sense that their requests are vanishing into a black hole and they really don't know when or if they're going to respond. We heard a few people talking about what kinds of information public bodies are allowed to keep to themselves, what kinds of information is exempt from disclosure, in other words. We actually found that there are more than 500 exemptions, about 550 exemptions from public disclosure in Oregon law, and they're not really collected in any one place. To find them, you'd literally need to go through the entire 18-volume set of the Oregon Revised Statutes. I made a little motion capture video for the very first meeting of our task force in which I did that with respect to just one of the multiple books, and I think it's a fairly enlightening read. So the members of the public, I would say we didn't get too many complaints about that, but we did get some. We also heard from a number of reporters especially that the state's practices with respect to electronic data are extremely hard to mesh with the 21st century business place that, you know, there at least, the members of the press at least, are starting to work in.
people talking about the difficulties of what they view as, you know, simple processes to extract data from a database. But in fact, it turns out that the state and local governments don't have these capacities necessarily. We have some of our computer systems that were built in like the 50s and 60s when computers occupied entire city blocks, you know, and you had to code things on paper, basically. So there's a lot of concern about how the state's data management and public bodies' data management is keeping up with the digital age that we live in. So those are kinds of the main things that we heard about from members of the public. And there was also I forget now when it was released, but recently released by the Secretary of State, an audit report looking into the public records issues within state agencies. That audit report was obviously very germane to the work of our committee, and it said a lot of things that were consistent with what we were hearing already, that in a lot of cases, routine records requests are handled just fine. Records requests that, you know, seek a single or an identifiable set of documents, and there aren't complicated legal issues. These are happening in a week, 2 weeks, and about 90% of the time that's the case. But that with more complex records requests, state agencies at least really struggled. And that is very consistent, I think, with the experience of all the government representatives on the task force, at least, and I think also with what has probably been experienced by a lot of the members of the press. The audit report also recommended that the state should consider an ombudsperson or an advocate position for the state to deal with public records issues, somebody that either a government body or a person trying to get information from a government body could go to seek assistance. You know, the public body may feel like the request is extremely overbroad and fishing and that it would be useful to narrow it, but if there is any kind of a relationship of distrust between the requester and the public body, that might be useful to have an independent person take a look at it and confirm, you know, for both sides whether one side or the other is in fact being unreasonable. So the ombudsman, an advocate idea, is one that we have been talking about a lot in our task force as well. So just to kind of recap the main issues that we have had brought to our attention, the cost of obtaining public records, the time frame with which in public bodies respond to public records, the complexity and inconsistency really of the exemption laws that allow things to be withheld from the public, the states and government's practices in general with respect to electronic data, I think largely the result of outdated databases and databases that probably weren't built, frankly, with the idea of public disclosure in mind. And then this idea for an advocate position. And we have been meeting, as I said, for about a year in the task force. We have had one subgroup to deal with exemptions that has met a number of times. And at this point, we are in the process of finalizing for the legislature's consideration a legislative concept that would address some, but not all, of these areas that I've been talking about. The decision to address some but not all of them was partly a conscious decision on my part, at least, and the idea being that I've seen, having lived through one of these, I've seen prior attempts to reform the public records law wholesale sort of crash and burn of their own weight, and it seemed wiser to me to see if we couldn't get a group of stakeholders to consensus or something approaching consensus on a few of these issues to provide a platform from which the task force could continue to work and come back to you guys in a future session with additional concepts. So the ones that we are trying to get addressed this session from the task force are time frames for responding to public records requests. I mentioned earlier that there is no current actual time frame for a public records response. There is very vague language about providing a reasonable opportunity to respond. We are asking that a exemption catalog be created, so an electronic, not in statute, we talked about doing it statutorily but decided that would be clunky and hard to use, but rather having the Attorney General's office come up with a user-friendly electronic catalog that not only shows people what exemptions are, but talks about what agencies may have records that are affected by the exemption, and also refers people to cases that are decided by Oregon's appellate courts, decisions from the Attorney General's office and the district attorney's offices with respect to what the exemptions mean. And then that would be kept up to date as the legislature acts on exemptions and also as the courts make decisions that relate to the public records law. So that would address, or begin to address, really, the exemptions issue. I don't think anyone on the task force feels like that's a complete solution. The idea really is to get the problem in one nice package and from there figure out what it is that needs to be done to address it. We're also proposing a policy statement should be added to the public records disclosure law. That may seem like not really a lot, but if you look at the Oregon public meetings law, there is in fact a very strong policy statement explaining that the policy of the public meetings law is meant to make sure that people are informed about not only government decisions, but what goes into those decisions, and seeing those decisions arrived at publicly. And the Court of Appeals in two recent cases has actually looked to that policy statement and decided cases in front of it in a way that actually implements the policy statement. So the goal partly would be to do a similar thing here. Another part of the goal would be if you're requesting records from an agency or a government body and you feel like they're trying to keep it under wraps, you have something very clear in statute that you can point to and say, hey, you know, your job here is to fulfill this statewide policy. Why are you obstructing my attempt to access information about your activities? And then the last thing that is in the concept that we are proposing for you, your consideration this year, is some protection for public bodies to deal with the reality that the public records law is complex. And that would take two forms. One would be a liability limitation, providing essentially that if you as a public body disclose something because you're trying in good faith to comply with the public records law, somebody can't sue you. As long as you were acting in good faith, you would be immune to a lawsuit, even if maybe you should have caught something in, you know, your 20,000 emails that you disclosed that you didn't happen to catch. And the second piece of that would be to provide that if you disclose something that is protected by a privilege, and probably the main one would be the lawyer-client privilege here, you don't lose the ability to claim that privilege in court. So it doesn't mean that you get to claw back whatever you disclosed. It just means that whatever you disclosed couldn't then be brought into court and then used against the public body. So the idea with those two things is really to hopefully provide public bodies with a little bit of reassurance that they can act, you know, fairly promptly on these things, and that they can do it without needing a lawyer to go through everything with a fine-tooth comb, even where that may be overkill. So that's kind of the gist of the work that the task force has done and what we're proposing. And I am not really sure about the etiquette, whether I should invite my colleagues to speak or invite questions from the chair and the members.
Why don't we go ahead and have your panel speak, and then we'll have questions at the end. Or we may interrupt and ask questions, you know, so just proceed.
All right, that's great. Rob, would you like to?
Sure.
Be sure and introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and Senators, thank you. My name is Rob Bovet. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I do have written testimony that I'd urge you to have a look at all of your spare time. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm not going to repeat anything that Michael said. I thought what I would focus in on why it is that finding consensus is both complex, but I'm also cautiously optimistic we'll get there. And so I just thought I'd touch on the four issues real quickly. First, I think we all acknowledge, and the Secretary of State acknowledged, that most public records requests are not complex. They're filled rapidly. In the electronic age, most of them are done by email promptly, usually without cost. That's not what we're really struggling with here. What we're struggling with are the complex, voluminous types requests, the requests for things that require us to go search through paper records in archives, things that are not just, hey, I need this document. With that being said, Michael's already mentioned kind of the four topics, and I'll see if I can explain a little bit about why we're probably going to bring this to you piecemeal over the series of a couple of legislative sessions at least. First, timelines. We have to come up with a scheme that works for both your mega state agency and a small special district that has no employees. So we have to figure out not just the timelines, the numbers, but the mechanics of it, and what types of escape valves are there for these complex and voluminous requests. And that's a real challenge. So we hope to have something for you this session you can actually enact. With fees, of course, there's this balance between cost recovery, reasonableness, and then there's also waiver. Our current law allows waiver when it's in the public interest, and so that's been a topic of a lot of conversation. The exemptions, you can look at them a couple of different ways, and Michael mentioned we have 550 of them. That sounds like a lot. It is a lot. It's fairly obnoxious. I don't know any other word for it. On the other hand, the way we've gone about it here in Oregon is different than, for example, the Freedom of Information Act or many other states, where you only find a dozen or so exemptions. But those exemptions are big, broad, and subject to a lot of discretion. Here in Oregon, we have 550 largely surgical narrow ones. So is it better to have 550 narrow ones or 12 big ones? I don't know, but we're struggling with that. I do, however, agree with Michael that because it's been a hodgepodge over the last 40-plus years, we probably can do some consolidation, streamlining, and modernization. Dispute resolution. For my money, if we could do an ombudsman and do it right, we could probably make a whole lot of people a lot happier, the media, the public, and public entities. I think Indiana's a good model. We're looking at a few other states as well. So I know the governor has expressed a strong interest in that, and I suspect she may bring something forward for you this session, and that would be great. If we could knock out timelines and an ombudsman this next session and leave us to struggle with the big exemption piece, for example, for maybe the next session, we can accomplish a lot. So with that, I'm going to stop and pass it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeb Bladine. I'm publisher president of News Register Publishing Company in McMinnville and representative on the task force for the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I still have my first copy of the original Oregon Public Records Bill. It's about four pages in a file on my shelf. And I've watched it grow into these 550 exemptions over the last 40 years. I'd just like to give a quick perspective on some things that we agreed on in this task force. It was a very agreeable, positive experience in a lot of ways. The first thing this diverse group of people agreed on was that the law has grown to a point that it really needs some fixes. And everybody agreed on that. The media, local government, the public people, everyone was kind of started on a positive area of agreement. We looked at these 550 exemptions, and after some kind of torturous look at what might be done with those, there's agreement that this was just too much to try to tackle. In as Michael pointed out, there was going to be a constituency for every one of these exemptions, and it was just going to that anything we did was going to die of the weight of that process. So we set it aside and did some alternative, as Michael mentioned. By that point, we reached the same conclusion about cost. That this was going to be a highly contentious, drawn-out process. Again, a lot more weight to this bill, and we set that aside, I think, for future consideration. I think that in those areas, this group, the Attorney General, others feel like this is a multi-year process on a piece of law that took 40 years to develop to where it is today, and there's not going to be one session or maybe even two sessions to try to fix some of these areas. From my perspective of the media, one of the things that Michael mentioned we think is very important is the liability issue. We hope that you protect that liability piece of this bill. For one of the reasons is that a majority of the exemptions that exist in law are really allowed exemptions, not mandatory exemptions, but they're treated as if they're mandatory by a great many people. And liability is one of the reasons. People see the word exemption, and if they give that document up, are they liable? So saying, no, you're not, and you can give that document. I mean, that's the state of the law. You're just allowed to withhold it. and it could help sort of change some of the dynamic there. And finally, just to agree with both gentlemen here, in our experience, we found that a lot of the problems and the conflicts that happen are really not the law, they're the people. The law it works in 90% of the cases, and sometimes there are people who are requesting records who are overbearing and want too much and are too demanding. And sometimes there are people who are providing records who will use the law as a shield because they don't want to release them, or they maybe just don't understand the law, and there's a process that takes a long time. For that reason, our association and most of the people on the task force, I believe, are very favorable towards the concept of an ombudsman in an appropriate manner, and there's lots of different discussion areas on that. We hope that there's a bill that comes to the legislature and that that is an area that moves forward. We think it'll be extremely positive to the overall experience with public records requests in Oregon.
Thank you. Before we have questions, I just want to say I wish my vice chair was here. She and I have been working on transparency issues together for 12 years, and we have that in common, and she has had an accident and couldn't be here, but we're thinking about her and hoping that she's here soon. Does anyone have questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you. I'm going to say your name wrong. Mr. Bladeen?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, I hit it on the head.
Yeah.
As a newspaper man, would you ever get concerned if they wanted to restrict your ability to come in and offer a FOIA, and then they say, no, we're going to limit you to this, and you really believe that you need that? Would you ever be concerned about a limitation put on you to get information?
We would be. We tend to consider ourselves the same rights under the law that anybody in the public has. So we would be concerned if anybody in the public were restricted from having that forum, as we are concerned with ourselves. We generally are trying to get information that we believe is of interest and benefit to the public. So we sort of consider ourselves. I guess if I understand your question correctly, we would be concerned.
Follow. Because where I'm going at with this is that a lot of times people go in and there are frivolous requests. They want 80 years documents. But there's other people, such as a newspaper person, that needs to get to the root cause of a problem, and they need X amount of documents to get there. My concern then is if you do an ombudsman and he says, well, I don't think you need all of that. Do you see that as a possible potential cause of problem for you?
I suppose if it were an arbitrary mandatory decision, it would cause. I mean, there's a law that says certain things are public, and there's a process to request and appeal through the district attorney or the attorney general or the ombudsman, if that's the case, or a court for an application of the law. So I guess if to the extent that an ombudsman would have the ability to just say, well, we really don't think you need that, that would be a concern. At the same time, I think we're very supportive of discussion. Sometimes we make requests for records that are too broad. And instead of going through a long process of this is going to, you know, here's how much that's going to cost, it's much better to have a discussion. What is it that you're looking for? And there's a role that an ombudsman can play. What really do you want? And what are you willing to give up, the holder of the record? And a lot of times, conflict is avoided by that discussion. It doesn't always take place.
Follow up. I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate, because if I was an investigative reporter, I wouldn't want somebody making a decision. If I told them I needed to know about the last 20 dozen apples that some agency bought, I wouldn't want this person determining what information I can look at and what I couldn't, because a lot of times if you get to the edges, you find information that you didn't anticipate, but it leads into a better investigative result.
Well, we actually have that situation now. It exists with the district attorney of every county, or the attorney general if it involves state records, or a court, so at different levels. Now, an ombudsman might supplant part of that process and be essentially replace the district attorney or attorney general, as happens in some states, or it might be more advisory and still leave the same appeal process. But at any rate, somebody is going to tell us whether or not we can get the records that we request, and maybe ultimately it's a court, which can go all the way to the, you know, as far as you want to take it to the court system. But there is a an arbiter in the law now.
Thank you. Senator Talbert.
Thank you, Chair Raleigh. I was wondering, we keep saying ombudsman, but can't be one. It's a big state, lots of things. Have you given, I'm sure you have, thought to the scope of the staffing for ombudsman services in Oregon? Who would pay for it? How big would it be?
Chair Raleigh, members of the committee, Senator Talbert. Hopefully I did that right.
We're not that formal.
Yeah, it's not that big a deal.
Not that big. Okay, that's good to know. So our proposal does not actually include an advocate, which I think may be what it's going to be termed, but I believe the governor's office will be proposing that. To your question, however, the Secretary of State archivist did give a presentation to our task force on various models around the country, and one that from her research appears to be both well-respected by governments and well-respected by media is in the state of Indiana, which is population-wise, I think, not too far away from Oregon. In Indiana, the entire state's ombudsperson work is done by an office of two people. So it may be that it's possible to do something with a statewide scale without investing a ton of resources. That said, I'm quite confident that the governor's office will be introducing a bill. I believe that my task force will be writing a report just generally to members of the public, which of course we'd be happy to provide to legislative leadership and members of this committee, outlining our support for the concept and potentially if we have any areas where we think the proposal could be tweaked, we may include some changes. But I anticipate that the financial impact of that may not be as great as your question is anticipating.
Senator Hayward.
Thank you. If you had to guess, there's sort of two-part question. To reflect Senator Talbert's concerns, if you had to guess, how often do you think the ombudsman would need to be used, given Mr. Bovet's point that the vast majority of requests are filled promptly and with a minimum of fuss and almost at no cost, at little or no cost? So how often do you think we need to use this ombudsman compared to the general volume?
Chair Raleigh and Senator Steiner Hayward, if we successfully implement a model like Indiana, not a lot, as it turns out. I mean, they do it with two FTE. In my experience, over the last 25 years, I've handled all of the public records orders, the reviews, the appeals in Lincoln County. Mm-hmm. And it's usually just a small handful each year. So it's not a huge volume. And I don't know the experiences in other counties, but like I say, most of them are dealt with just administratively, and it's not a problem. So if we do it right, I think the ombudsman could take that role, but also help others who aren't getting the entirety of what they're looking for, which kind of gets back to Senator Olson's question, and I think what Jeb mentioned.
And if I may, Mr. Chair,
sure.
Thank you very much. You know, to address the concerns that Senator, or to continue on in the vein that Senator Olson raised, Mr. Bledin, would it, and all of you, would it be your assumption that were you to go through the ombudsperson's process or advocate or whatever we decide we're going to call it and be told, well, you can have this, but you can't have that after a discussion of what you're looking for? I would think, but I hope you would be constructing in this way, that you could go back and say, hey, I understand you said I couldn't have this, but this is what we discovered, so we need to renegotiate this. Is that part of your thinking? Because I would hope that it would be to address the points that Senator Olson quite rightly raised.
Senator Riley, Senator Haywood, I think we would treat from the media that decision, depending on the law, whether that was a advisory or a, you know, adjudicated decision by the ombudsman. But we get that now. We go to the district attorney, and the district attorney says, you can have this, but you can't have that. And we generally go back, because it's very seldom we're going to file a lawsuit
right.
to appeal the district attorney.
Right.
We generally, unless it seems frivolous, now, from our community, we're going to be a little bit sad. We really like our current district attorney. Takes it very seriously, does a wonderful job, mm-hmm. fair and thorough job of appeals. Some district attorneys will look at something and say, no, you don't have to give them this. And you know, it's sporadic around the state.
Sure.
An ombudsman, we think, would add a level of consistency and training, and over time would it's interesting they talk about whether or not it should be have a final legal say mm-hmm. in that office. But there's another line of thought that there would be a de facto final say over time, because people would come to know that the ombudsman knew what the law was, just mm-hmm. as the mm-hmm. Attorney General does now, mm-hmm. and gave appropriate recommendations or decisions. But yeah, we would accept and not frivolously.
Yeah, no, I think my point, I wasn't, I'm sorry, Mr.
It's fine,
Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My point was not a concern that you would frivolously disagree or try to appeal the decision, but rather I was actually trying to support ongoing inquiry, because assuming that the ombudsman makes a decision and says, here's what you can get for this request, you guys accept that, you go in, you look at it, and then while doing that, you discover that, as Senator Olson said, you discover something around the edges that's really relevant. It's not just a fishing expedition, that you go back. And all I'm saying is that I like this idea a lot. The consistency, I think, is really important. And I would hope that, however it's structured, there would be an opportunity to go back, not to appeal, as it were, but to revisit, if you would, so that there was, because things come up that you don't expect, right? And there's information that isn't on the table when the first decision's made that may later be on the table based on the records you are permitted to review.
Chair,
that's
Riley.
All. It's more of a request, because I want to keep things open.
Yeah, I feel a little bit like maybe some loose language from my tongue has created some of these questions. I was thinking that the ombudsman might go to a requester and say, I don't think you really need this, in a sort of a negotiating pose, like to if the person would, you know, maybe agree that they don't need to pursue that at this time. Not that the ombudsman would be able to make a decision based on some concept of need that this is unavailable to you. And so, of course, if you agreed, you know, for purposes of the negotiation to drop part of your request, I don't think there's any notion that you would then be precluded somehow from going back and reinvoking.
Well, however it's constructed, I think Senator Olson and I both would want to see the opportunity to revisit.
Of course.
So a couple of things. One of the things that you said earlier is that people who are making these requests would say, it's your job to do this. And frankly, it isn't. Their job is something else, and they're being pulled off of their job to do this in almost every case. And I think that there are some states, if I'm not mistaken, who have actual department or people whose job it is to do records requests. And I wonder if you've looked at that and how extensive that would be, and whether we should be looking at that at all.
So, Chair Riley, actually in Oregon there are some limited entities that have that. It's really based on volume. So what comes to mind is we heard from the folks that work at the Portland Police Bureau, and I don't remember the number.
1,100 a month.
1,100 public records requests a month.
Ouch.
They have dedicated staff that does nothing but that because they have no choice. So it's really just a matter of resources and resource allocation.
Right.
Most of our members, and I certainly can't speak for special districts, but they're generally pretty small. There's just not a volume of requests that would justify having any FTE assigned. So we're literally doing what you described. We pull off the relevant people so they can get the records and filter them.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I think, Senator Chair Riley, members of the committee, I do think that Rob is right, that that varies a lot from agency to agency. I remember the last time I was in front of this body on public records issues, I can't remember now who it was, but there was one of the public entities came and said they had nobody to whose job it was to respond to public records requests. Mm-hmm. But I learned later that they had a $2 million PR budget, so they had lots of people who were employed to get out the information that the agency wanted to get out. So I think there is definitely there's differences between agency to agency, and that's one of the reasons why we've been very careful in constructing our time frames to try and come up with something that's going to work for everybody. To your original question, though, the idea of having dedicated staff to respond to public records requests, I think, to some extent, I think that the state is looking into that at an enterprise level, at least with respect to emails and electronic records, that DAS may be effectively the, you know, agency of the state that has effective control of those. There are, I think, in the federal government, most of their agencies have dedicated FOIA people whose job it is to respond to public records requests. I think the idea of implementing that, you know, from floor to ceiling for Oregon government entities is probably not feasible, but I would think it would potentially be worth exploring whether an advocate's office could also be staffed with people who could be sort of sent out to help public bodies on a case-by-case basis.
And that's what I had in mind, is not each agency having someone who's available to do it, but someone, and it could be, as you say, the advocate's office, have at least a couple or three people who, when these big ones come in, and the agency says, help, I don't know what to do, I need help, that there would be someone to help. And, you know, looking at email systems, for instance, you know, we have 39 different email systems. We don't have one. We have 39 different email systems in the state, in the state government. And so DAS is not able to get into all of those, but they could have someone, or the advocate's office could have someone who knows how to do it and could go out and help. And that's kind of what I had in mind. So,
Chair Riley, I'm picturing a public records SWAT team.
Excellent.
Theme song.
Further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Adam, what do we have now?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, our next informational meeting is to discuss boards and commissions, give them an overview. I just wanted to draw your attention to a few items on OLIS. At the request of Chair Riley as well as Senator Winters, there's been an interest to look into and otherwise provide oversight for the numerous boards and commissions we have in the state of Oregon. Towards that end, the two major public policy questions we're seeking to answer is, do all the boards and commissions currently provide a public good to the state of Oregon? And if so, what is it? Towards that end, took some time over the last few months and looked at the over 300-plus boards and commissions, creating an Excel spreadsheet, seeing, A, if they have a sunset commission, B, if they have met within the last 12 months, as well as a few other variables, namely, do members serve on it, do presiding officers appoint to it, that sort of thing. What we came up with was that Excel spreadsheet, which is on OLIS, that's color-coded. Everything in blue you'll see on that Excel spreadsheet is a board or commission that I can find no record of it meeting within the last 12 months. Everything you'll find in green on that spreadsheet is a board or commission that I can't find any record of it meeting within the last 12 months, but was either created by a federal law or an executive order, or is otherwise required under state law to perform some sort of licensure activity or required for us to get any sort of federal funds. Everything in red you'll find is a border commission that already has a sunset date placed on it. The vast majority of these are task forces. And everything in white is a border commission that has met within the last 12 months. The final total for everything in blue is we've got about 37 boards and commissions that I can find no record of meeting in the last 12 months. So, again, to Chair Riley's request, we've created a series of questions that we hope to survey those 37 boards and commissions to determine what public good is being provided by them. You'll find a copy of those questions on OLIS. Very interested in getting the committee's take on them. And finally, the third document you'll find on OLIS is the 2012 Secretary of State audit on boards and commissions that really informs a lot of this work. And with that, I believe we have the governor's executive appointments director, Mary Moeller, here to join us.
Mary, come on up. Thank you for coming to help us out with this.
Oh, well, I'll do my best. good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mary Moeller, and I'm the executive appointments director for Governor Kate Brown. I've been asked here today to give a brief overview of the governor's executive appointments. Governor Brown very much values the tradition of citizen involvement in Oregon and is responsible for making appointments to over 250 boards and commissions in the state. She is grateful and appreciates the vital role that citizen volunteers play to make sure we have a broad representation on our licensing, policymaking, advisory, and governing boards. The governor has prioritized making sure that Oregon's many boards and commissions reflect our state's citizenry. Our office works diligently to make sure we have a balance of gender, race, and ethnicity, and geographic representation from all of Oregon on boards and commissions. I work very closely with the governor's director of equity and community engagement, Serena Stoudemire-Wesley, to ensure we are identifying a diverse pool of candidates to serve. In addition to Serena, I work hand in hand with the governor's policy advisors, the administrators of boards and commissions, and stakeholders to fill expired and vacant positions. The membership requirements for each board that come from the statutes guide our efforts, and together we recruit and identify potential candidates for the governor to consider. Once identified, we ask candidates to fill out our interest form that is available on our website. And as many of you are aware, we have Senate-confirmed and non-Senate-confirmed appointments. We just got through some today. Yay! For the Senate-confirmed appointments, the governor must submit names 21 days prior to the Senate Rules Committee's scheduled meeting during sessions and interim legislative days. Candidates that are required to go through Senate confirmation often reach out to many senators, which you are probably aware of, prior to appearing before committee. The non-Senate appointments are being filled all year round and are not subject to confirmation deadlines. Our website provides resources for interested candidates. Those include the list of boards and commissions and their brief descriptions in what we call the board book, the vacancy and expiration lists that provide the list of openings and opportunities, and the membership handbook that summarizes the board system and board service expectations. So I appreciate you asking me here today to give a brief overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
So, yes, Senator Olson.
I'm glad you're here, because looking at today's confirmation list, I was a little concerned that we were remiss in people from the east of the mountains and South Valley. Is that something that the people just don't want to, from those particular areas, don't want to perform in the committee or on the appointments, or is it that they were precluded?
Senator Riley, Senator Olson, members of the committee, thank you for the question. I think you're right. I think that it is one of the harder objectives that we have to make sure that there is geographic diversity among the boards and commissions. And outside the valley, it definitely is a little bit more challenging to make sure that we have that representation. We really do our best to make sure that that balance is there. I would say that each list that passes through confirmation isn't the whole picture, though, that you're seeing on a lot of these boards and commissions. They're the vacancies and expirations that come up. You know, there may be more one round than the other, but it definitely is a priority of the governor. It's something that she often makes sure that we are asking the question and make sure that representation is there.
Follow up?
Yes, go ahead.
But I didn't kind of hear the answer I was wondering, trying to get to. Why is there this deficiency of East state folks and southern state folks? Is there a specific reason why we don't have that, or is the pool very limited?
Chair Riley, Senator Olson, members of the committee, I believe, I don't think that they're precluded. I don't believe that we're doing it intentionally. I do think that the pool is smaller. It is more challenging. But I do think that we put an effort in daily to make sure that we're trying to recruit from those areas and make sure that that representation is there.
Thank you. Also a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I noticed the same thing. Glad you asked the question. Southern Oregon often feels like we're part of Northern California. And don't feel represented, rightly or wrongly. And I think the numbers, even if we had other than the list we saw, we would see a disproportionate absence of representatives from afar. Are expenses, travel, anything recognized for people coming from afar? Because it's one thing to give up an afternoon or a day to come to a meeting when you can drive, and it's another thing to have to spend two nights in a motel and drive 6 hours each way. So, are we doing anything? And also, have we done active recruitment? I guess I would ask.
Chair Riley, Senator Talbert, thank you for your question. I think, and Senator Olson, you as well, thank you for making sure that we talk about this, because it is important, and I do think it's important to the governor. It really depends on the board or commission. The statutes really dictate whether members are, if they have the budget to reimburse for travel. So a lot of them are different, and that is set up when they're set up, right? Whatever the statute says and whatever the legislature says on their budget. And so that does, if a board or commission does have that ability to do the reimbursements, it's a lot easier to recruit from, let's say, Central, Eastern, or Southern Oregon to say, we are going to reimburse you for your time and your travel. But not a lot of them do that. So I think that that is something that we could probably do a better job of, but it does usually cost money. But there are, oftentimes on the recruitment side, we are often looking to organizations all across Oregon that are doing a really good job of identifying leadership in every corners of the state and working with them to identify those folks. Thank you for your question.
Senator Rolls. Thank you. Would the governor consider looking at the list we have that was so competently done, looking at those committees that don't do anything, and then looking through and seeing which committees pay and which don't, and then offering forward legislation to say those that don't should get some stipend to pay these people, because it is expensive for them, and if $200 or $300 out of their pocket to be on a committee is, you don't get anything for it. You don't get a little badge or anything. So right. Do you think the governor would consider putting forward legislation to make those committees that don't pay, putting in a stipend so that they can pay?
Chair Riley, Senator Olson, I can certainly make that suggestion to the governor from your question. I can't commit her to anything today.
Right, right.
But
will you ask her?
Yes, I can ask
tell her.
Tell
her it was me that did
yes,
it.
Yes, and I can tell her.
You may not want to do that.
No, don't do that.
Senator Steinhardt.
Thank you. Just to add to this conversation, first of all, I have been asked over time, not surprisingly, to recommend physicians who might be on the Oregon Medical Board. And I can tell you from personal experience, it's really tough to get people to serve if they're not living in the Valley. And I would say something in particular. I've been chairing the General Government Subcommittee for the past 4 years. The advocacy commissions, Commission on Women, Commission on Hispanic, Black Affairs, et cetera, all come through there. And we did several things to help. First of all, we added some travel stipends into their budget for exactly the reasons that you pointed out. Second of all, they made a commitment to hold at least one meeting a year outside the metro area, the Salem-Portland access, which I think is very important. Now, some of them, like the Oregon Medical Board, you really can't do that. You have to have the meetings at the board because it's all set up in a certain way, and there's a lot of staff, and et cetera, et cetera. But others, I think, can. And third, I would say that we have historically not done as much with new video conferencing technology and things like that as we could. And we've had requirements that for people to be active members, we've just started to allow people to testify by phone in the legislature, frankly, in hearings. And that's not even sworn testimony or any official position. I think we have to take advantage of new technology to start to improve access to serving on these boards and commissions via video conferencing. Sure, it's not anybody who's ever been on the conference call knows that it's not the same as being in the room, but it's better than not being part of the conversation at all, and especially if you can do video. And with our community colleges developing more and more distance learning and our regional universities developing more and more distance learning options that include video conferencing, there's no reason we couldn't avail ourselves of some of their facilities in partnership with them to give people the opportunity to do that there. So I think if that requires a statutory change, and if this committee is going to run a bill to potentially get rid of a bunch of unnecessary boards and commissions, I would love to see language in there that says that people can participate by phone or video on a regular basis in order to increase participation from people who live more than 150 miles from here, you know, or however often.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it works. The technology is there now, and I think we need to be taking advantage of it. So that would be the one other piece I would add to this conversation to address the concerns raised by Senator Talbot and Senator Olson.
So, and we are planning to have a placeholder bill that we will discuss later on what we think should be in it, or if anything, but we will have a placeholder bill. And just so you know, and I think you probably do know, that My goal is to look at the boards and commissions that don't appear to be doing anything and discovering, hopefully, that they are doing something or else they go away, and so that the ones that exist who are doing something can get better service, be more apparent, and hopefully have better membership. People volunteering from everywhere in the state, and if there are fewer commissions and boards, people wouldn't get so, you know, overwhelmed. And so that's my goal, and I think that we want to pursue that and possibly add in some other issues if the committee has some things that they want to put in. But we will have a placeholder bill that we can do this with. Any further questions, comments?
I got a question for Adam. Could you go over your colors again? I just finally found the chart.
Who? I most certainly can, Senator.
Did you put a key in here?
I didn't. It clearly is my fault. It's true. Everything in blue is a border commission. I couldn't find any record of having met within the last 12 months.
Which doesn't mean they didn't.
So blue is bad.
Blue is bad.
We can remember that. Yeah. Thank goodness for alliteration.
Green is, couldn't find any point of them meeting, but they're either created by an executive order, a public law, an act of Congress, or we need them to otherwise get it some sort of federal stream of money. The reds were something that already has a sunset on it. The vast majority of these are task forces. And everything in white is something that doesn't have a sunset on it, but I can find a record of it meeting within the last 12 months.
The reason I ask is because I'm on the task force for the Willamette Falls. And we do meet, and I just said, well, he's saying we don't do anything.
No, but you're sunsetting.
Yeah, we sunset.
Yeah, right. That's what that is.
So we don't have to worry about the ones that sunset, basically, right. Unless, but the only thing we have to be careful about with them is that we don't just automatically renew everything.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, that's something that we will certainly look at, just in the way we look at other sunsetting things like tax credits.
But, Mr. Chair, I will make mention that I just got a letter, and they want to have the Army Corps of Engineers study the Willamette Falls locks for 3 years.
Oh, please.
And they want the state to put in $2 million to do the same study in parallel with the Army Corps of Engineers. And so our sunset, we'd be 2 years dead before we even got the letter back to say what we could do with it.
Yeah. Are you serious?
Three-year study.
A three-year study, and they want the state to do exactly the same
right.
study at the same time
at
for
same
$2
time.
Million?
Parallel.
Why?
Examination.
Okay, don't even get me started. Sorry, Ms. Muller, this is not your problem.
Like this is over my expertise.
Above your pay grade, is it? Okay, well, if we have nothing else, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'll be talking with you again, I'm sure.
We will be in touch.
Okay.
And before you get away, I'd like to chat with you personally on the side.
Okay, great.
So, Adam, anything else for the...
The only other thing I'd say for the good of the order, Chair Riley and members of the committee, is the intention is to finalize the survey in the next couple of weeks, send it out to the 30 so in blue. The hope is, while this is happening, I'm working on a database that provides about 40 or 50 variables for every board and commission currently listed here. So using 3 or 4 weeks to survey the boards and commissions while I'm working on some internal work, I'll definitely include the mileage issue that has been brought up, whether or not the board and commission has a mileage part of their statute. And hopefully we'll have some data for you when we meet in December about who was answered and in what manner to the survey questions. So. With that's all I have, Chair Riley.
Mr. Chair, one other really quick thing. Just looking at this, I should have asked this question earlier, but the vast majority of these, I think, look really solid, and they're clearly actively working. There's a few in here that I kind of wonder about, and I wonder why we need... Do we need both an I don't know enough about the missions, right? Like Employment Appeals Board and Employment Relations Board, or could their functions be merged? Do we need...
Right.
What does the Environmental Health Registration Board do that DEQ couldn't?
Right. And that's something
I think that's the next question that we should take on about whether we can merge some of these, the way
right.
we merged a lot of the health licensing boards.
And I agree with that, and that's one of the things that prompted this is I'm on the Senior and Disability Services, and we meet together with another board.
Right.
And
why do you have two boards?
Yeah, there's no reason for us to have two boards because we always meet and we always, you know, work on the same stuff together.
Right.
So one board would do where we have two. And I think there are a lot of other places where that may be true, and that's something we want to look at. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, I'm going to end this meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To end this meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.